Jake moments. Jake was a mean logger whose dramatic conversion I observed as a small child, and it caused me to call subsequent dramatic moments of encountering God Jake moments. In my first book of stories, entitled That Reminds Me of a Story, I detailed that conversion as well as others. The work of God goes on. Here are only a few of the abounding Jake stories that I continue to observe. The leather jacket, the chains, the rings in every part of the visible body caught my attention. Who knows what kind of thoughts brought that about? Desire for attention? Expression of self? Rebellion? Fitting in with the crowd? Who knows? But here he walked. I didn't notice his family following him at a discreet distance, but when he entered the water and his family cried unashamedly, I noticed everything and turned away to hide my own tears. This occurred at Applegate Christian Fellowship, led by Pastor John Corson, located in Southern Oregon. Their summertime outdoor amphitheater meetings permit all the congregation to gather together at once, though their growth is making even that prospect dimmer. At the close of those Sunday morning services, the response to the call is usually massive and is followed by baptism in a creek-like baptistry. Corson often spends hours baptizing and praying with the people who come. My emotions overflow as I watch young and old families and individuals who come. When God wins, boy, he wins big. Beside the swimming pool of a large vacation center that was built to house the Young Pioneers, the youth indoctrination program of the communist regime in Hungary, I watched as something new and glorious happened in that country. In the blossoming of their freedom, young people were turning to God and sealing that new relationship in a great baptismal service. In spite of the drizzle adding a slight unpleasantness to the surroundings, joy reigned. At one point, I could restrain my tears no longer. A young married couple, now serving the Lord together, walked into the pool, and their pastor, Greg Opeen, baptized them together. I heard the applause, but could barely see the hugs through my tears. On the final night of the gathering, as I closed the message, two young people responded to the invitation, a young man and a young woman. After a later communion service, I returned to my bungalow to prepare for leaving the following day. As I and four others sat in semi-darkness because of an electrical failure, the young man who had responded made his way haltingly up the porch steps and tapped on the door. We invited him in, and as he choked back tears, he told us in Hungarian how thankful he was for what had happened. He had been deeply moved and was so very glad now that he knew the Lord. Well, I and the Lord had a good talk afterward. Back when Zimbabwe was still Rhodesia and the civil war raged, guerrilla fighters had driven farmers out of the Northeast Highlands. One farmer, a man I befriended while there, told me about his conversion. Having been driven off his farm, he could only wait and hope to return. However, in a fit of defiance, he decided to return and fish in his lake. He and a worker drove to the farm. When the farmer got in the back of the pickup to watch for any military activity as the worker drove toward the lake, unfortunately, they hit a landmine in the road. As he related it to me, he went up into the air as a sinner and came back down as a Christian. Well, few things touch me more than to see homes built or restored. In a California church at the close of the second Sunday morning service, a drama unfolded that I missed, but someone in tears told me later. As people streamed toward the front in response to a call to salvation, unknown to me, an older, divorced couple sat on opposite ends of the curved balcony from each other. They were also unaware of each other's presence, nor were they aware that the other was responding to the call to repentance. From those opposite sides, they met each other at the front and fell into each other's arms as they also fell into the arms of God. It was the third morning service at Fort Lauderdale. This morning, something most unusual happened that left me melting before God. The stream of seekers began, somewhat to my surprise, but this was different. Within seconds, I realized that it was almost exclusively couples walking arm in arm or even walking in embrace toward the front. I knew that new homes were beginning at that moment. Repair was occurring. Sins were forgotten. Forgiveness was flowing. Do you remember me? That kind of question creates high tension in me as I search my memory. The question came from a smiling lady after service at Harvest Christian Fellowship in Riverside, California. Yes, her face was familiar, but I had to plead ignorance. She continued, "A year ago at Atchison, Kansas, I asked you to pray for my husband to be saved. We prayed, and you also recommended some of your tapes that would help him understand God. Well, when I got home, we had a six-hour Gail Irwin listening session, and..." She turned and pointed to someone standing a few feet behind her. I hadn't noticed him, but now her husband walked up to me with a beaming face and arms outstretched for a hug. He had come to know the Lord as a result, and they wanted me to know. A home was now complete. I must have looked funny, smiling so big and crying at the same time. My life for God began as a child. Though this means I do not have a dramatic testimony, I am grateful beyond words for the remorse God prevented by this early decision, and also by the increased amount of learning available to me because of my upbringing in a thoroughly Christian home. When I see children respond, I want to grab each one and hug them, welcoming them into the kingdom. Some, depending on age, might be embarrassed by that. In some cases, I simply observe and exult at what I see. Jacobs are being turned into Israels all over the world. Question: for whose conversion are you currently praying? 2. Whose conversion other than your own has meant the most to you? Evangelist. My father's injury and disability brought us to a relationship with almost all of the famous tent evangelists who populated the 1950s. Because of their emphasis on healing and our own desperation for healing, we traveled to wherever they were. Names included Oral Roberts, Gail Jackson, Jack Coe, and A.A. Allen. They each had the world's largest tent, and they were big, seating around 10,000 people. This story about Jack Coe begins when I was about 5 years old. My parents had started a church in Pascagoula, Mississippi, about 1940, in the early days of World War II. Military installations dotted the coast, but the largest one was Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi. We often had visitors come from there to our church. One tall, gangly visitor joined me in the front of our church property where I practiced the universal activity of little boys, throwing rocks. After a brief conversation, he picked up a rock and actually threw it over the tall pine trees that surrounded us. I could not believe what I saw. I handed him another rock and asked him to do it again. He obliged. Finally, his begging for relief exceeded my begging for him to throw, and he went inside, leaving me with memories of Olympic, to me, rock throwing. 40 years later, I learned that the visitor was Jack Coe, who had just become a Christian and whose zeal in his new relationship brought him into conflict with military expectations. He came to my parents for fellowship and comfort through his trials. My second encounter with him was not so direct and personal. My early teens coincided with the height of the tent revival season. By then we knew and followed, to some degree, the schedules of them all. Unfortunately, living in Greenwood, Mississippi, tended to be a bit off their normal path. However, an interesting side effect of the tent revival phenomenon had a semi-tragic humor to it. The guys with the big tents could be called the major leaguers. They attracted the largest crowds and the most press attention. Frankly, some of what they did was awe-inspiring, while other activities reeked of manipulation and fraud. But I digress. Each of the major leaguers had certain readily identifiable quirks that set them apart from the others. Oral Roberts, for instance, claimed a certain feeling in his right hand when he thought there would be a healing. A.A. Allen claimed oil dripping from his hands. William Branham claimed a halo. Gail Jackson seemed to be the only one intent on teaching while emphasizing the baptism of the Holy Spirit. Jack Coe? Well, Jack had a strange approach that I even hesitate to express. When he would pray for people for healing, he sometimes would ask them where they hurt, tell them to raise their hands and close their eyes, and then would hit them where they hurt as he began his prayer. Well, God let him get away with it, and people were actually healed. These major leaguers spawn minor leaguers, men whose tents were not so large or whose press coverage not so extensive. The minor leaguers sought to attach themselves to the success of the majors by adopting the idiosyncrasies of the evangelists they felt to be the most successful, which brings about this story. A Jack Coe clone came to my town. He set up what must have been the largest tent in our county. He seemed intrigued by the fist of Jack Coe. One night, when people were coming across the platform to be prayed for, he asked one brother where he hurt. "My stomach," came the reply. He then instructed him to close his eyes and raise his hands. This clone then hit him in the stomach. The man was not healed, but he was knocked unconscious. Well, when consciousness returned, the unhealed man was also not fooled. Now the unfooled fist did not ask where the evangelist hurt, only where he would like to hurt. And the evangelist was now unconscious. By next morning, the tent and the evangelist had disappeared. Well, my grandparents seemed to be ahead of the game on technological developments. They had a TV set as soon as they were practical. However, in some church circles, TV was the ultimate enemy, and many preachers abandoned the hunt for the roaring lion and turned their attention to rabbit ears. Jack Coe was one of them. He called it television. He graphically described it as the devil's tail sticking up from your roof and leading right down into your living room. Well, in this day and age, I'm inclined to believe him more. Once when Coe was conducting a crusade in the hometown of my grandparents, they invited him to a lunch in their home. He accepted. This sent my grandmother into an ethical tizzy. They had a large TV right in the middle of their living room. She insisted that my grandfather take it away before Coe came to visit. He refused, saying that it would be hypocritical. Daily, she insisted. Daily, he refused. However, my resourceful grandmother figured out what to do. When Coe arrived, much to the humor of my grandfather, the TV set was appropriately fully covered with a sheet so that he wouldn't see it. Grandpa laughed and said, "Ma, he can't miss it now." The 1950s were communist hunting Joe McCarthy days. Everyone talked of spies and treason. Radio evangelists raised more money to fight communists than to preach the gospel. Well, Jack Coe got in on the wave. He promised that on a certain night in his big tent, he would reveal the biggest communist in the United States. Now, you had to have a ticket to get in that night. The tickets were free, but Coe expressed that he hoped you would use discretion in passing them out. Although I was skeptical as an early teenager that Coe would have any sort of access to such information, it seemed like good theater, so I was there. The message was weak, but at least it was long. He masterfully delayed the revelation until after the offering had been taken and the sermon had reached a prolonged conclusion. Actually, the sermon and the revelation were totally unrelated. I struggled all evening to make the connection. Finally, the revelation came, almost as a side and afterthought. The biggest communist in the USA was Kate Smith, the famous God Bless America singer. I can't even remember what I thought other than disbelief when it was over. I guess you have to be careful what you sing. Questions. What experiences have you had with what might be called revival? 2. Can you describe any manipulation you felt from religious leaders? What will $2 get? Do you recall the story of the lady whose groom came in out of the field in overalls to get married? Well, here is the rest of the story. Every month I published a small newsletter for the people of the church and passed it out in service and mailed it to those who were not present. Every time this lady received her newsletter, she would write a letter in response, giving her own personal news to me. Each letter from her would contain a prayer request and would have a dollar bill hand-sewn into the letter. One letter seemed urgent. Along with the dollar bill came this request: "Please pray for rain. If we don't get rain this week, we'll lose our crop, and I cannot afford that." Well, frankly, I don't remember any details about my prayer, but that week we had the ideal rain, taking almost the whole week to deliver an inch of rain. I paid little attention until about 10 days later. I received another letter from this lady. This letter thanked me for praying for the rain. However, rather than the usual dollar bill, $2 were sewn to the letter. The prayer request this time was, "Pray that God will resurrect my old husband. I don't like this new one. He won't take me to church." Well, I suppose that she thought that if a dollar brought rain, perhaps $2 would get a resurrection. Questions. What do you expect from God because of your generosity and faithfulness in giving? 2. What do you think my own reaction would have been if she had sewn a check for $1 million to the letter? Killer faith. I opened my morning paper and quickly scanned the headlines. The typical news portrayed a troubled world, but one headline troubled my world. I didn't want to read the article, but I knew I had to. The headline read, "Faith Kills Boy." I later discovered it was on front pages around the nation. The article related the story of a couple whose small son suffered from diabetes and needed frequent medication. At a church service, an itinerant preacher prayed for the boy and declared him healed. The parents were informed that they no longer needed to provide medicine. In faith, they withheld his medicine, and the boy died. Fellow church members urged the father to claim the resurrection of his son. For several days, they lived in a combined state of expectancy and denial. Finally, with the police involved, the couple was charged with manslaughter. Both of them were convicted. The husband spent jail time. When I read the article, I could not know that just a few years later, this couple would submit an article to a magazine I published, the manuscript entitled, "Some Things I Learned from Watching My Son Die," detailed several items of their new maturity, two of which stand out in my mind. First, they stated, "We learned that God is a God of reality. When he heals, he heals. If he doesn't, he doesn't. Either can be verified." I thought of all the misery they suffered in claiming by faith the life of their son. They had been taught that if they used the right words and never made any sort of negative statement, regardless of realities, then their claims would come about. My mind drove that theology to its absurdity. Suppose, for instance, one of my grandchildren asked me for an ice cream cone. The odds are very good that they would get it. Well, I might get one too, you know. However, I would never instruct them to hold their hand as if they actually had a cone in it and lick the air, all the while proclaiming its good taste, and then, if they faithfully did so throughout the day, I might give them an ice cream cone. I would never do that to my grandchildren. Well, the second lesson the couple learned was that love is greater than faith. He said, "We acted in faith toward our son, but we did not act in love, and love is greater than faith." Paul states that in 1 Corinthians 13:13. These words rang in my ears, how totally obvious, and yet how totally unnoticed we find that statement from Scripture. Questions. Have you ever believed something and later wished you hadn't? 2. In what ways have you been religiously manipulated? Mare and Colt. The pastor asked if I minded stopping by a corral with him to feed a parishioner's horse before we headed for the Sunday morning service. He explained to me that the parishioner was on vacation, would be back in a few days. I assured him that I not only didn't mind, but being a horse lover, would enjoy the stop on the way to church. He gathered the feed and went to do his regular chore as I walked along with him. This time was different from other feeding times. The horse skittered back and forth and seemed unwilling to take food from the pastor. With mounting frustration, the pastor sought to resolve the problem, speaking as comfortably to the horse as he could. Finally, he turned to me and said, "I don't understand this. This horse has never done this before. Perhaps she's bothered by your presence." I admitted that could possibly be true, though horses are rarely that discriminating when it comes to food. I offered another solution. "I think that if you'll move away from between that horse and her colt, she'll calm down." Realization covered his face, closely followed by sheepishness. He moved to the side, and immediately the horse became manageable. I thought of how often I accidentally got between my congregation and their Lord and couldn't understand why they were so unmanageable. My job is just to get out of their way and feed them. Questions. What actions or statements have you heard that make God seem more distant to you? 2. What do you do to make it easy for people to approach God or believe in Him? Mr. Clean. At a certain Christian college, the president of the student body this particular year could only be described as Mr. Clean. He was so straight and straightforward that no one believed he had ever even imagined sin. As it happened this particular semester, the roommate assigned to him in the dormitory could only be described as Mr. Dirty. If anyone prayed much, it was for the salvation of Mr. Dirty. During the course of the semester and during a time of spiritual intensity, wonderful things happened, and Mr. Dirty had his encounter with God. The place was ecstatic. Now, campus tradition mandated a celebration. When the hand of God moved so greatly, they would have a giant bonfire to celebrate what God had done. They gathered around the fire to worship and perhaps write their sins on a piece of paper and throw it into the fire as an act of repentance and forgiveness. In fact, if there was something that they felt had separated them from God, they could throw that into the fire also. Well, Mr. Dirty had something to throw away. His extensive collection of pornography, now deemed unnecessary, headed for the fire. One problem. Mr. Dirty had a job on that Friday night and could not be there personally to throw the pornography away, so he asked his roommate, Mr. Clean, to throw it away for him. Now you need to see this scene in your mind. Here are 1,000 students gathered around the fire. The spiritual temperature is as hot as the fire. Then here comes Mr. Clean, the president of the student body, with his arms full of this trash. As he made his way through the outer edges of the crowd, others would look at his armful and exclaim, "Oh, I didn't know." And the buzz would begin around the circle, whisper to ear, whisper to ear. The sweat began to flow from the brow of Mr. Clean. As he made his way through the more tightly packed crowd near the fire, those around would look down at his armful and remark, "Oh, I didn't know." The inner circle whisper began. By the time he reached the fire, sweat poured from his forehead and every eye was fixed on him. Mr. Clean looked around, threw a magazine into the fire. The crowd cheered. Mr. Clean exclaimed for all to hear, "It's not mine, it's not mine." He threw another into the fire. The crowd cheered again. Again he shouted, "It's not mine, it's not mine." Well, would you say he was uncomfortable? I realized that when Jesus hung on the cross, he had every ounce of my sin and crud and yours hanging on him, and never once did he proclaim, "It's not mine." Questions. If you were Mr. Dirty's roommate, would you be able to throw his pornography away so publicly? What alternatives might you suggest? 2. What does Jesus dying for our sins mean to you? The Secret Agent. Seeing Jesus clearly, as I discovered and explained in the book The Jesus Style, changes absolutely everything in your life for which you become profoundly grateful. The major change area is in how you view people. Once you understand the great love and grace of God toward yourself, sheer gratitude pushes you to be loving and merciful to others. Prejudices crumble, differences fade, relationships grow. A major test of this view of Jesus came in 1978 in Africa. I was invited to teach at an interracial renewal conference. Well, anxious about delivering my message on the servanthood nature of Jesus in a different culture, I pre-preached it to one of my black students from East Africa. He informed me that they would love it and that I would be the first white man they had ever heard say that. I also determined to be with each of the races at the conference. I shared in my normal, strange, humorous style the traits of Jesus and spent rewarding amounts of time among the blacks there, hearing their stories, eating with them, getting to know their colorful names, learning words and phrases in their Shona language, visiting their offices, praying for them, having them pray for me, having my eyes opened. On the last day of the conference, one of the white brethren, whom I had come to know and I saw frequently, approached me after one of my visits with a young black man and pulled me aside to talk with me. He said, "I'm going to tell you something that you're not supposed to know," he began. "I'm a member of the Secret Service of the government, and I have been assigned to watch you. I want you to know that if our people had treated the blacks the way you have been treating them, we would never have had a civil war." He walked away, and I stood there stunned. What I had done was merely a natural outflow of the nature of Jesus. Though I should have been highly affirmed, I became deeply sorrowful, even depressed, that this had not been the natural process of the church. Questions. What experience have you had where you thought you were doing one thing and discovered that you had accomplished something else? 2. If you have read The Jesus Style, in what ways have you noticed that you adopted the nature of Jesus? Parts as parts. In the letter to the church at Colossae, Paul writes that Jesus is the head of the body, the church. Now that realization clarified something for me. It also caused me to come up with a saying that I think will make me famous. It's this: if you see a body without a head, it's dead. Now remember that you heard it here first. The sadness of it all is that if you were to attend all of the churches in any given city on any given Sunday, you'd discover that some death is there. Now this grieves me, but the problem is simply that they have chosen to separate themselves from Jesus, either in attitude or action. Perhaps they even doubt his existence. They certainly don't consult him. They are a body separated from the head. That also reminded me of a rather gross, and you don't have to listen to this part, story. I'm an old farm boy, and we farm kids know that chickens don't grow up inside plastic bags with weights and prices written on them. Whenever my grandmother needed to feed the farmhands, she lacked the luxury of a quick trip to the grocery store. That was a once-a-month, all-day affair. She simply walked to the chicken yard and, with a special hooked stick, grabbed a fryer by the leg and pulled it out. Then the grossest thing would happen. She took the chicken by the head and began to whirl the body around and around until the body flew off and the head remained in her hands. I told you this was gross now. For the next few minutes, that chicken was the most active it had ever been in its life. Flop, 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 run, 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 flop, flop, flop. Now, an untrained observer might conclude, what a live chicken. But the fact is, that chicken was dead. It had been separated from its head. Sometimes, churches that are dead vote to increase their activities. Flop, 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 run, 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 flop, flop, flop. Now, an untrained observer might conclude, what a live church. But the fact is, that church is dead. It has been separated from its head. Jesus is the head of the body. Questions. Describe some unusual actions of your grandparents. 2. What rituals of the past have disappeared from your life? Ruined weekend. The plane, full of party types, whooped it up on the way to Las Vegas. For some reason, they took up with me, so I whooped with them. As the activity died down, I got up to go to the back of the plane. The ringleader of the party spotted me and called me over. Hey, mister, just what do you do? I gave my ready answer. I have more fun than anybody in the world. I believe that, he respouted. I go all over the world teaching on the nature of Jesus. He slapped his hand to his forehead and exclaimed, oh, my God, you just ruined my weekend. Me? What did I do? You just said that word, Jesus. Now I have to think about this. Just saying that ruined your weekend? Yeah, I'm on my way to Las Vegas. I'm looking for women. And now I'm going to have to think about this because you just said that word, Jesus. Too bad. I did not sorrow over his ruined weekend, but I did have a brief opportunity to share the gospel. Question. What have you observed happening when you say the word Jesus to someone you don't know? 2. If someone observed you in a crowd for 30 minutes, how do you think they would describe you? Shh, it's a secret. Secret societies. Secret societies trouble me for several reasons. The fact that Jesus was light and in him was no darkness at all seems incompatible with membership in something secret. The fact that Jesus said men love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil lays a severe indictment on secret societies. This is why I avoided fraternities when I was in college. I didn't avoid sororities quite as much. However, I was inducted into an honorary fraternity while I was in college. I don't remember the name exactly, maybe Eat a Bit of Pie or something like that. And I'm not sure why I was chosen, except maybe it's because I did not blow up the chemistry lab. On the night when I was to be brought into membership, they ushered me and others into a candlelit room. Now, I'm always suspicious when I'm in a candlelit room. I usually think that this is going to cost me something. Even when my wife cooks a wonderful meal and we eat by candlelight, I enjoy it, but I always feel just a twinge of suspicion that this is going to cost me something. At any rate, they brought us into the candlelit room for the induction ceremony. To my surprise, the leader in the course of the evening announced, "And now, the secrets known only to the members of this fraternity." I thought, "Oh, brother, this is not supposed to be that kind of society." When he finished relating them, though, I almost laughed. I thought, "Don't worry, those secrets are safe with me." The secrets were no more profound than saying circles are round and squares have corners on the edges. I thought living in the light still beats secrecy. Subhead, secrecy in the church. With a group of highly skilled academic men, I shared in founding a magazine. The purpose was to provide a forum for theological subjects to be discussed in an unofficial manner within a certain denomination. These men, whose lives had been on the front line of church planting, of missions, and teaching, had managed to be spared the realities of denominational politics, which I had, on the other hand, been in a position to observe intimately. And they were most surprised at the extremely hostile response on the part of officials to the magazine. Well, the founding of our magazine coincided with revelations by a national columnist of some questionable financial activity on the part of the top person in the denomination. The resultant charade of political action caused us to propose a sunshine resolution, similar to the Freedom of Information Act of the federal government, that would permit access by any ordained minister of the denomination to the minutes of any meeting of the denomination from committees on up, except for those of discipline that would compromise an individual's privacy. Now, one would think that a biblically oriented organization would immediately see the light of that call and back it fully. Such was not the case. Secrecy reigned stronger in the denomination than in the Pentagon. 28 of us involved in the magazine were summarily removed from the denomination without hearing or notification. When we were reinstated, though, even before we knew, we had been excluded, as some cooler heads eventually prevailed. I'm writing something that, to this day, has never been revealed. Secrecy still reigns. However, darkness is sought only for one reason. Questions. When you try to keep a secret, what effect does it have on you? 2. What does walking in the light mean to you? Shell Top Camper. Now, I understand this story to be true and that it happened to some people I know. I'm not about to check it out. Many years of pastoring the same church resulted in a whole month of vacation every year for the pastor and his wife. Their favorite form of vacation was camping in a pickup with a camper shell sitting in the back. One particular year, as they neared the end of another joyous rest and they made their way home, they found themselves further away on Saturday night than they had planned. It would be necessary for them to drive all night to be back in time for him to preach the next morning. As the journey droned on, the pastor finally said to his wife, "I can't do it. I'm already sleepy and it isn't safe for me to continue driving." She responded, but we have to continue on. You're expected back in the morning." He drove a while longer and finally gave up. But all was not lost. His wife said, "I'm not sleepy. Let me drive. You can get in the back of the camper and go to sleep while I drive." Excellent idea. They stopped. He got out and walked back and into the camper, took off all his clothes except his shorts, and settled into a deep sleep while his wife drove. After a couple of hours, she became a little drowsy herself and almost missed a stop sign on a lonely wilderness stretch of road. In fact, she had to put the pickup into a power stop that caused it to shudder rather violently to a stop. She hoped that it didn't wake up her husband in the back. However, he woke with a start and immediately thought, "Oh no, we've had a wreck." He quickly but groggily stumbled out the back of the camper to look around and see what she had hit. At that moment, his wife had regained her composure and sped off into the dark wilderness. He ran and yelled, but to no avail. Now here he was, dressed only in his shorts beside this almost deserted road in the middle of the night. As the occasional car passed, he would try to flag a ride, but they would only speed up. Finally, a highway patrolman drove along, stopped, and asked him just what was he doing beside the road dressed only in his shorts. "Well, I'm a pastor," and "Sure you are. Here, breathe into this balloon and walk this line." Finally, sobriety at least proved. They took him to the station, and a quick phone call to one of his elders at the church verified to the police that this was indeed the pastor of their church. After all the chuckles were over, clothes were provided and money loaned to charter a light plane to fly him on home. One problem. He got home before his wife and didn't have a key to get in. So he sat on the front steps to wait for her. Sure enough, just before dawn, the headlights of the pickup turned onto their street. As she turned into the driveway, the light fell on her husband, and she was so shocked that she hit the accelerator rather than the brake and demolished the garage. Well, that's the end of the story. However, I often wonder what went through the mind of the elder who knew the story, and whether he was able to keep a straight face as his pastor spoke that morning. Questions. What parts of this story would you have the most trouble believing? 2. What are some funny things you have observed about your pastor? Tender ears. Louisiana suffers from the highest illiteracy rate in the nation. Now, that made literature evangelism somewhat wasteful at my first pastorate in Venice, Louisiana. The state legislature, which is known for, let's not explore that subject, decided to deal with that problem. They spent quite a sum of money putting up billboards across the state that read, "If you are illiterate and want help, call the following number." Now, illiterate people are not lesser people, they just simply can't read. I learned some wonderful lessons from some who were reading challenged. Love and wisdom are not always products of literacy. Well, in a state other than Louisiana, a 50-year-old widower was courting a lady of his age who lived in a big city about 75 miles away. They faithfully wrote to each other every few days. What she didn't know was that this widower could not read or write. However, he had a trusted friend who would read the lady's letters to him and return the dictated replies. Once, when this trusted friend was away on vacation, a letter arrived from the city lady. What was he to do? His friend was gone, and no one was available to read the letter to him. No one was available, that is, except for a 12-year-old nephew. Well, the problem? This letter contained things that a 12-year-old's ears should not hear. What to do? No problem. He simply covered the nephew's ears while the nephew read the letter to him. Oh my, you write the questions for this one. the funeral, the constant gnawing, foreboding feeling forced me into the most difficult situation. I must tell my wife that for reasons I cannot explain, I feel that we should forego an after-Christmas trip to see her mother. Well, to my great relief, she expressed the same feelings. The gathering storm was invisible to us. The Sunday after Christmas showed its predictable blandness, that is, until the evening service. I arrived after the doors opened to see a family of five standing in the foyer with an arriving congregation gathered around them. I watched and listened, fascinated, as Jesus shined out of all they said and did. When I met them and learned more, I was jealous that they lived 800 miles away. They were visiting his parents in our town, and they hesitated to come to our service because he heard that we dressed very fine. I winced at that reputation, though the church did have the best location in town. At my probing, I learned that the commitment of the family was real, with all of them being soul winners. He, a former bomber pilot, had rented a plane and flown to our city with his family. They planned to return the next day, which would be Monday morning. Though their presence brightened our day, Monday returned me to routine, and I let the memory slip away. Tuesday's paper carried a small 2-inch item indicating that a small plane was missing, but I made no connection. Wednesday's article, a larger one, arrested me. I knew this was the family. By Thursday, when hope was abandoned, I immediately found the parents and sought to assist them if they needed me. They had been without a pastor for 9 months and clung to my offer. On Saturday, the plane was found in a thick forest. He had lost his way in a major storm and run out of fuel. All were dead. I stayed with the parents, assuming the burial would be 800 miles away, but then discovered that they would be buried locally. His pastor planned to come over for the memorial service. Now, new information. The family owned a dry cleaning plant that had prospered, but nonetheless they chose to live a simple lifestyle to free funds and time for missions activity. At Christmas, the family would draw names and present gifts to each other in a unique way. Each person described to the recipient what they planned to give, but rather than the gift, only the thought was given, while the money for that amount was put into a jar for a missions trip. Before Christmas, they would take the money as well as abandoned clothes at their plant down to Mexico and spend a week of friendship and evangelism. You might think them morose over this, but quite the opposite. They were a happy, active, water skiing type of family, but now they were gone. Another bit of information shook my world. The father of the wife was a wealthy, hostile, Christianity-hating person who despised his son-in-law and openly hoped to see him someday crawling back to him for a job. His hostility toward the son-in-law and that son-in-law's Pentecostal church exploded as the funeral approached. He refused to let that Pentecostal pastor have anything to do with his daughter's funeral. Well, now the arrangements fell back to a decision by the son's parents. They asked me if I would do the ceremony. I accepted, smiling at the humor of it all. At the visitation times in the funeral home, the in-laws never spoke to me personally, which was fine with me. However, they brought their lawyer with them, and he relayed any messages to me they desired. Well, their main message was, "Keep it short." I smiled and said I would consider it. I knew that I was free to do whatever I wanted. At the visitation, I learned even more. This son I would be burying was so highly esteemed that, as one person related to me, if he told me that building across the street was going to jump 3 feet into the air, I would start staring because it certainly would. 5 people sought me out during the visitation time to ask me how to become a Christian. Each seeker described the loss of such a man and family as so unthinkable that they wanted to be a Christian to help replace them. Well, I long since abandoned any attempt to answer the question of why. At the funeral service, I detailed the ways that the family had stored their treasure in heaven, where moth and rust and corruption could not reach. At one point during my sermon, the father-in-law, remember the wealthy one, and his daughter, who hung fawningly on him at all times, looked up at me and shouted, "Would you shut up?" As the 5 hearses carried the bodies to their final resting place, I pondered the hostile misery of the living father-in-law, contrasted with the benevolent peacefulness of the buried son, and wondered at a justice that someday I would understand. Questions. Who do you know that you would consider to have died an untimely death? 2. If you have had any friends or relatives who died, what are some things about them that you miss?